So we're here tonight with Kathy Kelly's help to kick off the Undrone Upstate Walk tomorrow from Hancock Reaper Base, just outside Syracuse. And our destination is the Niagara Air Force Reaper Base near Buffalo. Niagara Air Force Base in Hancock, the home of the 174th Attack Wing. Right. Attack Wing of the New York National Guard. These are two of a number of hunter-killer Reaper bases spread throughout the U.S. and the world. Hancock operates its deadly robotic Reaper drones over Afghanistan 24/7. They've been doing that for several years. In recent years, war-torn Afghanistan has become Kathy Kelly's second home. There in Kabul, the capital, she writes her dispatches and works with the Afghan peace volunteers. I had the opportunity several years ago to spend a month in Kabul, hosted by the Afghan peace volunteers. This remarkable group of mostly young people come from the diverse regions and diverse tribes of Afghanistan. This isn't the first time Kathy has kicked off an action to expose war crime at Hancock. She was among the Hancock 38, arrested there in 2010. It seems that our First Amendment rights have eroded to the point where citizens are arrested for petitioning their government for redress of grievance. First Amendment right. Kathy is no stranger to walks for justice and against war. With her Chicago-based human rights group, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, she's taken part in several long walks across the upper Midwest for justice and against war. In a moment, you'll get to hear Kathy. No doubt you'll probably get some sense of why she has twice been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I spent some months in Iraq with Kathy in 2003, before, during, and after shock and awe. She is a woman of grace, depth, humor, intelligence, passion, and courage. You'll see that Kathy is also a person of applied and articulate compassion. You'll see she's a person whose grassroots political compassion goes far beyond the armchairs and silos of safe and comfortable activism. Please join me in welcoming this lovely person, Kathy Kelly.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's wonderful to be here. I'm grateful to Ed for that introduction. It's lovely to see all of your faces here tonight. And to the Syracuse Peace Council, to all of the many people who've kept the actions at Hancock going, and for all of the ways in which really Syracuse has been a magnet and a witness. It's quite wonderful to be here. Last night I was talking with a group of young people at a college in Maine. And the teacher bought the class, and I thought, well, now what are these students going to think, that, you know, they're digging their way into debt to listen to an ex-con who never pays their taxes get up and talk to them? But I do want to start by saying that after we had tried to deliver the loaf of bread at Whiteman Air Force Base, and for me it was really important. I had recently come back from Afghanistan, and you start every meal with a disc of bread. And, you know, these kids can't come and talk to people in the United States about their grievances, but I can, and I could try to represent their grievance. And we assembled peaceably, and we really did believe that we should talk with the commander of the base about how do they help the drone operators distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, and had anybody been killed that day by the weaponized drones? And if somebody decided, I don't want to do this job anymore, how do they get out of that job? We had lots of things to talk with him about, but of course we were escorted off in handcuffs, Georgia Walker and me. And the judge at the trial found us guilty, and he went right into sentencing. And my friends were looking at him, looking over my resume more or less, and they were all kind of putting up six fingers for 6 months. And The prosecutor, he was so earnest. He was a military lawyer. I wish I could find him, because he said something that actually was true. He said, "Your Honor, Miss Kelly is in great need of rehabilitation." And in a way, going into the prison system is the rehabilitation I need, so that I'll recall what our prison system does by separating people for months and years and even over a decade in some cases. And the pain and the anguish that people feel separated from their children and their loved ones, and the squandering of resources. It was very, very important for me to go into the prison and to realize it's a very, very broken system. I mean, kind of symptomatic, emblematic of that. Miss Paula, whose face could have been in a framed oil painting, she was just such an august figure in the prison, white hair and a small braid going down the back of her neck, and soft brown eyes and golden skin. And she, however, like most of the women in the prison, did not find it easy to go up three flights of stairs, which was the norm. You dropped your dishes off to be cleaned in the basement, and then you had to go up three flights to where most of us were living. And the elevator always was broken. And there was Miss Paula hauling herself up the stairs, and she had such good humor. At one point, her heart beating and she was sweating, she stopped and she made a joke. She said, "Oh, I'd give my entire month's salary to help fix this elevator system." Well, that would be $6.82. So a few of us said, "Oh yeah, I would too." And I think we had been ready to earn $24. And when you went to work in the morning in the kitchen, the gas leaks in the kitchen were showed that that was broken. You'd wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning, the fire alarm system would go off every night from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning every 5 minutes. I mean, the place was broken down. The system is broken down. There aren't halfway houses to receive people that get early release. It's a broken system. And I'm directionally challenged quite often, and so I was just trying to find my way around the Lexington minimum security prison for women. I'd been in the prison before, but maximum security, and now they've got the women in the minimum security. And so I was just kind of wandering around and trying to figure out what was where, and I walked into what I thought was a storage room, and it was actually the chapel. And the women were practicing with the gospel choir. And a woman named Sylvia asked me, "Well, what are you?" And I said, "I'm a soprano." And she said, "Oh, we'll do the la-las." And I'm a good Catholic, I do what I'm, la, 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 la. She said, "Soprano." And so I was part of the gospel choir. And at the end, I'll ask Colleen to come and help me recall what they taught me there. But I do have this idea of how do we unshackle ourselves from these systems of war and imprisonment. And a book that's been, for me, very, very important is written by Jim Loney, his memoir of having been captured in Iraq. And he was held captive for 118 days. And he was released. And Tom Fox, who was one of the four, was taken away from the other three and killed. It's a very, very searing and difficult book to read in many ways. But one of the strange things about their captivity was that while they were being held captive, they actually found the key to their own shackles. And so after the guards would leave at night and the room would be dark, they were all shackled together, but they'd pull out the key and unshackle themselves. So they could at least roll over, and then before the guards came back, they shackled themselves up again. And that, to me, has been a very important symbol. Is there some way that we can unshackle ourselves? And Jim struggled with whether or not to really try and make a break for it, like jump out a window and go. But they didn't know where they were, and they didn't know if they might then occasion their own murder. And I can't recommend the book strongly enough, Captivity by James Loney. But I want to go back to that idea of unshackling ourselves. We know that the drones purportedly supplying intelligence, the surveillance drones, about patterns of life in places like Afghanistan are woefully, woefully inadequate. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about some of what I knew from firsthand experience. I hope you'll indulge me in going back to some time that Cynthia Bannis and Ed and I and others had spent in Iraq. I have no skills as a nurse, as a technician, in any of the healing arts. I wish that I did, but I don't. But while we were in Baghdad in the 2003 shock and awe bombing, which was shocking and was awful, we were with a Dr. April Hurley, and she could make a difference in the emergency room, and so she would want to go over there, and sometimes she couldn't go unless for some reason the Iraqi government, while they were still in power, said I had to be there too, so I'd feel completely in the way, but would go with April. And you could see how hard it was for the hospital workers to deal with families coming in with their loved ones, the bodies ripped apart, the bones broken, and there was chaos, and somebody had to kind of sort people out and say, you can go this far, but you can't, and people were screaming, and somebody had to come and try to clean up the pools of blood that were happening as people came. I mean, you can't imagine in a war zone how stressful, how difficult these hospital situations are. But I can imagine it a little bit. I remember being in Gaza, and while there were bombs exploding once every 11 minutes overnight, when I went into the Al-Shifa hospital, I remember one of the doctors put his head in his hands were shaking, and he said, all these 22 days, we do not even know what has been used against us. The white phosphorus, the dense inert metal explosions. Just we know that for 22 days, the world watched and nobody came to help us. Mm-hmm. And so I think about the reality of people trying to deliver health care, trying to do it under very, very difficult circumstances. And I want to describe to you something so fraudulent that it almost creates a sort of a sickness. And that's not because I want to make us sick, but I want to help us become honest together about where the United States seems to be moving. Just in these first 6 months of 2015, the United States AID, it's Aid for International Development, has been maintaining, as it has for many years, a presence in Afghanistan. Now, there's a very principled person named John Sopko, who is the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. It's called SIGAR. And it's remarkable, this man quarterly delivers to the U.S. Congress a very full and scathing report on the corruption, the fraud, the graft, the inadequacy of many, many, many of the non-governmental organizations and governmental organizations that have been functioning in Afghanistan. And many of his staff are people who previously filed reports for the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, SIGIR. And they also found corruption and fraud. But one of the things that came out in a July 25th letter from Special Inspector General John Sopko to the head of the Aid for International Development was that of 641 projects for healthcare delivery in Afghanistan that supposedly USAID was teaming up with the Afghan Health Ministry to maintain, and of the list of all the coordinates, the geographical coordinates of where those places were within Afghanistan, it turned out that 80% really couldn't be located. Six of the places that the USAID claimed it was funding were located, actually, according to the coordinates, in Tajikistan, a northern country. Six more were located in Pakistan, and one was located in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. There were 189 which were given as coordinates for hospital projects, and when they use basically Google Earth, they call it geospatial analysis, when 189 of these places were located in Afghanistan, there wasn't a single building within 400 yards of the coordinate, and in some cases within a half mile. So I guess you would call these places ghost hospitals. They don't really exist. And actually, there's a whole another long list of ghost schools and ghost students and ghost teachers. And people are skimming money, getting paid, making up ghost budgets. And in this case, with the healthcare facilities, apparently somebody is getting the money because the money has already been dispersed by USAID. Now, it's chump change in terms of the Pentagon budget. The Pentagon is spending about $35 billion this year in Afghanistan to maintain 9,800 soldiers. We again have something in the vicinity of $2 million per soldier for a year if you were going to divide it up that way. So I realize that the amount I'm thinking of in this case, $234 million, does not seem to be such a huge sum in terms of the big budget. But it's the principle, I suppose, that would bother me anyway. And I knew that in 2011, the same pattern had happened. USAID was clearly laid out, called on the carpet. The Congress knows. It's all presented to the Congress people. Nothing happens in terms of an investigation or a conclusion. Well, you probably can see where this is going. A ghost hospital. An extremely reputable group, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, had in very difficult circumstances built a hospital compound the size of a football field. And then there was one building that's the actual hospital. It's not the living quarters, it's not the mess hall, it's the actual hospital. And anticipating that there would be fighting and it could escalate, they had sent very carefully the exact coordinates for their very real hospital in the week leading up to this tragic, terrible attack of the United States on that hospital. 354 people had been treated for wounds, many of them, in the hospital because of the fighting. The doctors and the nurses didn't run away. They were incredibly brave, and 59 of those people were children. And in that hospital building, there were doctors and nurses who weekly had been notifying the United States military, the Afghan military, and the United Nations exactly what their geographical coordinates were, so that if there was fighting, in the event that there was aerial bombardment, it would be clear this place is a hospital. And the week of October 3rd, those coordinates had been called in one more time. So I state that because there was no doubt, it's patently obvious, that to engage in aerial bombardment of that particular spot was something that was done with prior knowledge that it was a hospital. Or maybe even if somehow the communication hadn't gone through. Once the first bomb hit the intensive care unit, a nurse who survived said she could not find words to describe the horror of the patients burning in their own beds. Once the first bomb hit at 2:05 in the morning, frantic workers notified their organizations. The organizations told the United States military, "You're bombing a hospital," and the bombing continued in 15-minute intervals until 3:15 in the morning. And the hospital is in rubble, and their windows which had flames blazing out of them. And there were 22 people killed, and at least 12 of them were medical staff, and 3 of them were children. And now, I suppose you could say, it's a ghost hospital. And what of all the people who live in that region? The closest clinic is in a place called Pulai Khumri, and it's more of a extended village. Kunduz was the 5th largest city in Afghanistan. And where are people going to go for maternal care, for infant care, for pediatric care? Where are they going to go if the fighting continues to rage? And those that were brought to Kabul, and that must have been a very arduous journey, were brought to hospitals where the census was already filled. And Kabul is a place of great violence right now. My young friend said last night they were up all night long, a 10-hour gun battle with explosions, and they weren't sure that they'd make it through the night. Is there no mercy on the part of the people that are in our Congress that get these quadrennial reports that understand surely that when the head of the Doctors Without Borders insists that there must be an independent international investigation of what happened that cannot include any of the parties to this act, and the United States military says, well, it will be under investigation. July 19th, the United States helicopters attacked an Afghan military outpost, and they killed 10 people. And then the United States military said, well, we'll investigate. And I tried hard all day yesterday to see if I could find some thread, some word about that investigation, not a word. And so it's not acceptable to say that the United States will investigate, the United States military will investigate. I believe right now, as Amnesty International, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNICEF, certainly Doctors Without Borders, the Emergency Surgical Centers for Victims of War, all of these people are raising a very insistent, almost like the wagons are circling round, demand that there be an end to the attacks of the United States aerial bombing on places that are meant to be enabling care for people. There has to be a public outcry as well. Yes. And that's our work. So one thing Voices has thought of is that maybe people could go to healthcare facilities here in our own locales. In Chicago today, they went to Stroger Hospital and they asked doctors just to take a little bit of time and come out in the white coats and stethoscopes and join with people with a sign like the one that's here. To bomb this place would be a war crime. The same is true in Afghanistan. I think the United States has been banking on people in the United States kind of forgetting about Afghanistan. And we know how important literacy is. We care a lot about literacy in our country. We need another kind of literacy. We need to embark on extending another kind of literacy, becoming literate in the stories of the consequences of people who can't run away from our wars. There's some stories that I find I can't really return to myself. And I know others of you will understand this. If you've experienced traumas, you just kind of need to let that story rest until it is the right time to go back to it. And so I'd just like to offer you one of those stories. It's actually from 2 years ago in my own life, but it's something I think I can perhaps behold a little better now in my life. I was home alone in Kabul at what we call the Border Free Center. My young friends have got quite a thriving center going right now, and it's the place where the big heavy woolen blankets, we call them the duvets, are organized, the project to make these duvets is organized there. And it's also a place where little child laborers come in and they become literate because the kids have organized a street kids school, and these blue scarves are made there, and it's a really wonderful place to be. But I happen to be the only one there because youngsters were either in school or going up the mountainsides to visit widows and try to figure out who might be the ones who would actually be making these duvets, 20 Tajik women, 20 Pashto women, 20 Hazara women, to make it inter-ethnic and draw women from the different tribes. And the women then stuff the wool into coverlets, sew them up, and then these big heavy blankets are given away for free because of the generosity of people in the United States and the UK and Australia, really. And the women are all paid a living wage. So it's been a wonderful project. Others were out visiting the families of the street kids because every family is given a big sack of rice and a big container of cooking oil. And the deal is, let your child kind of retire from being a vendor on the streets and begin to become literate, begin to study math, study these courses in nonviolence, and we'll compensate for what the kids would have earned on the streets. And so again, through generosity of people outside of Afghanistan, the Afghan peace volunteers have been able to organize this for 100 kids. So they're often out and about. And I heard a racket at the gate, and I realized, no, I better go down. It might be one of the kids. And I opened the door, and in immediately came two women, and my heart sank, because I was pretty sure I knew why they had come. And sure enough, they had walked a long, long way from Barchi. They had probably walked about 3.5 hours, and they were tired, and they were thirsty and hungry, no doubt. And they wanted to be part of the women who would be on the list to make those heavy blankets. But I knew the list had already been formed. And you can't have an endless number of people who will, we just don't have the wherewithal. And I certainly am not the one to make that call anyway. And so I was trying to use what diary I have and be polite. And the older woman, a kind of grandmotherly, maybe about my age really, she began to thump her breast and she started to cry. And the younger woman lifted up the older woman's skirt to show me a festering wound on her ankle. And they talked about how they could only feed their children stale bread and tea. And I've heard this so many times, and the statistics bear it out now. There's a rise in severe acute malnourishment in Afghanistan, a rise in food insecurity, a lack of clean water, no health care. And I was trying to say that, you know, there really wasn't something I could do. And so the women did something that I do understand. They sat down. And the older woman took my hand and stroked it and begged me to help. And well, then Sonia came back, and Sonia was the keeper of the list, and Sonia would have to tell the two women, as she would have to tell many, many, many more women, "I'm sorry, I'm so very sorry, but we can't help you this year." And then ever so gently and politely, she escorted them back through the gate, and then I saw Sonia go off around a corner, and she came back, and her eyes were red. My friend Hakim, the medical doctor from Singapore, and I call these women with deepest respect the women who won't go away. They're doing what they should do, what they must do. And I think maybe one of the only groups that matches their tenacity and their resolve are the United States generals. That won't go away. They won't go away. And so they try to scare us. You know, if you don't support this, you won't have jobs in your community. As though we're not able to ask what kinds of work are appropriate and valid to do. Part of our literacy, part of our education, must become increasingly asking that question: is it valid work? Is it ever valid to teach another person in any form to kill, to rip apart, to shred another human being? Is it ever valid to pay people, to employ people, to keep other people separated from their loved ones for years and years and maybe even decades? So what kind of work is appropriate in a time when we so need people to be retrofitting the housing stock and helping us deal with climate change and building mass transit systems and taking care of our elderly people and starting Head Start programs for the children? All of the people could be given meaningful, good work to do. And then they try to scare us. You know, if you don't bankroll everything that the so-called Defense Department wants, then ISIS will be a threat to you. But I think back to those hospital scenes, and I think back to 8-year-old Dima in the Al-Fanar Hotel who befriended Ed and Cynthia and me. And I think back to that little girl looking up apologetically at her father because she was standing in a pool of her own urine. She was so frightened by the bombing. And I remember his face, a look of disgust and anger and fear. And I think of sitting in a hospital ward with little babies that would never leave that ward. The economic sanctions were punishing them to death. And my friend Martin Thomas, a nurse from the United Kingdom, looking at the other mothers with the babies in their arms and murmuring, "I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it? A death row for infants." And I think about going to the Buka compound after the Shock and Awe bombing. Three young teenagers had come, and they whispered. They were so ashamed of their own memory. They whispered to me, "We were in the Buka camp." And they paraded us naked in front of the women's U.S. soldiers. And we had to beg for our food and sometimes bark like dogs or say, "I love George Bush." And sometimes we were so cold we tried to dig a hole in the sand, because at the time it was a tent, primitive tent, prison encampment. And they try to warm up by burrowing in the sand, and they were afraid of desert snakes and desert scorpions. And when I had a chance to go into the camp and visit some of the friends they'd left behind, those friends told the same story, so I believe that they were all telling the truth. But there's another truth, and that's that the so-called caliph, the so-called head of ISIS, Ali Baghdadi, spent 5 years in that prison. And it was from that prison that he recruited some of the people that became his main aide-de-camp people, if you will, for ISIS. So yes, if somebody goes from London or goes from Chechnya or goes from the United States and joins ISIS, I find that difficult to understand, but I also find it difficult to understand why somebody from the United States would enroll in an armed force and go clear across the world to another country where they don't speak the language and they don't know the culture and be willing to sometimes torture and sometimes kill. But when it's a matter of people who've lived in Iraq and they've gone through the 1991 war, I was there during that war, and it was a brutal destruction of their infrastructure. They've gone through the economic sanctions. They've gone through shock and awe. They've gone through civil war. They've gone through Abu Ghraib. They've gone through the callous ways that the United States and foreign occupations have treated them. Do we think that if we again bomb and torture and kill this population, there won't be the rise of an even more extremist, a more fundamentalist group than ISIS today? War is not the answer. Abolishing war would be the way for a decent future. And my young friends in Afghanistan, they know it. They know it so well that today, even though they were frightened to death last night, they're organizing themselves to help the families that have sought refuge from Kunduz. These are the young people who could lead us toward a better future. And many of the women I met in prison are the people who could lead us toward a better future. And our determination together to say we will unshackle ourselves from these systems of war and prison with every bit of ingenuity and energy and finding courage from one another, collective determination. So Ken is asking a question about how young people in the United States, for instance, can reach out to and better understand young people in other parts of the world, like Afghanistan. So I'm myself very privileged on the 21st of every month to be part of a phone call. It's called the Global Days of Listening, and Vicki is remembering that as well. And the Global Days of Listening phone call involves people sometimes from Gaza, sometimes from Palestine, sometimes from Australia, from the United States, various schools here, and the Afghan peace volunteers. And it's been very fascinating as those youngsters grow older, you know, 18, 19, 20, they really do have a lot to say in terms of commentary on current events. And it's been fascinating to listen to people's exchanges. So you can do that. It's a Skype phone call. The technology is not perfect, but it works. Another thing you can do is go on a website called enough.ourjourneytosmile.com. And I have some literature in the back, and you could find these connections that way. And our friend Hakim, he's a medical doctor, but he's really very, very interested in film and in visuals, photo essays. And so he's got, between photo essays, articles, and films, just 3-minute short films, quite a documentation of the young people's lives in Afghanistan who are part of either the Border Free Center or the Duvet Project or the Street Kids School or the Live-In Community. So I think that would be something that young people could be encouraged to dip into. It's hard to get into the schools. I think that teachers, even university, tenured university professors sometimes, seem anxious about letting ex-cons who never pay their taxes come into their schools. So I get more invitations, I suppose, than many. I don't want to be whining, but I wish there was more of that going on. And so if you can ever encourage people, you know, just give a half hour of your class over to somebody who is wanting to work toward social change, or who perhaps has returned from some of the places that we forget about, where we're waging wars, like Afghanistan. I really do mean it about the literacy. I think we need a literacy in the stories of the people who can't escape wars that the United States has waged. And the United States may claim it's a war of necessity, but I think these wars have been wars of choice. And when we start to get that literacy, then I think we start to realize that the United States has unleashed a level of chaos and mayhem and destabilization and murder and torture, such that it can't be repaired by the United States. It can't be fixed. I think we should pay restitution. We should reconstruct that hospital. We should pay reparations. But I don't think it's up to the United States to decide who would be the upper hand in these terrible civil wars, or where a border would be drawn. I look to the day when the United Nations will be restructured, and the United States and other groups that have distinguished themselves as warlords wouldn't have such a strong voice in the United Nations. But at the moment, I think it's patently clear, and certainly the bombing of that hospital underscored that. It's clear that the United States is not in a position to be an exemplar of peacemaking. So how do young people, with their idealism and their altruism, begin to understand that? Well, you've got the ROTC, and you've got the military recruiters, and Dick Hill, you know, trying mightily to interfere with that terrible process, but they're going into the schools all the time. So if there is some way to insert a peace presence inside the schools, that's, of course, always valuable. And I think that young people wonder about those folks that are out on the streets with the street heat. So I think that's valid and valuable as well. You know, think about the Occupy Project. What was it? It replicated all that vigiling that we've done for decades. So if I can just summarize Vicky's question, Vicky is asking how we can help people in concrete ways understand the unity of the various struggles, because people really are up against some of the very same kinds of oppression or kinds of impasses as they try to work towards social change. This past summer, Voices walked from Madison, Wisconsin to Volk Field, and we really wanted to make sure that we would get more or less equal play to the reason why we started in Madison. We started in Madison because in that city, a young black man had been gunned down, and it is very similar to the targeted assassination that the drones are accomplishing. Racial profiling and signature strikes have a macabre and a terrible commonality. But, you know, in both situations, there are no questions asked. There is no time set aside to detain someone, to ask a few questions, and much less to think about a jury or a trial. And, you know, in our criminal justice system right now, even if you are charged, you have very few chances to go before a jury. But the similarity, the terrible similarity, and, you know, Medea Benjamin has gathered women together whose sons were killed by United States police officers or in some way were killed while in custody, and once every 28 hours, a young person of color in this country is killed while in police custody or by a policeman or by some vigilante group. So Medea and others have asked the mothers, will you come and join with us and talk with us, and maybe we can help amplify your voices? And they've asked the mothers, do you know anything about the officer who killed your son? And again, it was a veteran of United States wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I want to say, you know, arms open, welcome those people who come back from these traumatizing and miserable war zones, sometimes maimed, sometimes terribly traumatized. But I think We also have to recognize that when you train people to kill, when you train people to use brute force, that just doesn't click off because they take a plane back into the United States. So to organize our events and then consistently try to figure out how can we reach out and really make this event encompass the cares and concerns of people we know are dealing with very, very similar and terrible realities. And I think when the Witness Against Torture Fast happened this past year in January in Washington, D.C., the Hands Off campaign in Washington, D.C. was also planning their events. And so it was very good to watch how people had a joint panel and then really met with one another. Marsha Abadiah Coleman met with Matt DeLuisio and others from the Witness Against Torture and figured out how we could jointly have a demonstration and nonviolent civil disobedience and really support each other's campaign. So it takes some concrete, practical dialogue. And sometimes maybe, in a sense, letting go of some of our most important priorities to say we want to, you know, also give attention to and a voice to other people's priorities. I want to say that if we invest a lot of our energy in elections, I think it can be a bit of a distraction from what you're suggesting we need to do, which is to kind of roll up our sleeves and figure out how to solve problems in a communal way. And it's certainly wrongful that we all have to be kind of competing with one another for an ever-shrinking amount of resources while the Pentagon just simply is like a demonic suction cup and takes those resources. And so I think it is important to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience actions that help us bring these realities to whatever extent we can before the media, before the courts, and before the court of public opinion. But I think it's also good to try to talk with the kids as much as possible. I've been impressed. One thing that my young friends in Afghanistan do is they just take a magic marker and they write on the palm of their hand. In fact, I'm going to ask people tonight to do it with me so I can send a picture back to them. They write in their language, bas, or they write enough in English. And then they take a picture of that. And it's just their expression of their own frustration. We've had it, enough of war and warfare. And so, you know, people certainly don't want children to be used as, you know, political footballs. We want to be careful about that. And yet I wonder if it's not possible to give more expression to the voices of children who basically are children of war living in the poverty circles in the United States. And so maybe, you know, have some of those kids write enough on their hands. And I think it's also important to try to link up as much as possible with the places where people are displaced by wars. Particularly, I'm thinking about the refugee populations. And, you know, it is interesting that in Europe and Australia, there are people that are working hard to create what they call welcome committees. I love one of the graphics. It's the entire continent of Australia, and then it says, welcome, there's plenty of room. Well, you know, I can see Syracuse may not be saying, oh, yes, please expand our refugee population. I get that. But there will be more and more Syrian refugees coming into the United States to try to understand ways of expanding that sense of communities issuing a welcome. I just came from Portland, Maine, and it's you know, sustained its problems economically, that's for sure. But with voices, any time we knew of a new person coming over as a desperate refugee into the United States, we'd say, go Portland, Portland, Maine. And people were given good care until they got this new governor. So, you know, to truly welcome the diversity that comes into our communities, and then to eschew the idea that there ever could be such a thing as borders that separate some people that are more worthy than other people. And again, I'll refer to my young friends in Afghanistan. They embroider on a blue scarf. It says border free in English, and then Bedune Mers in their language. But I think keep on cultivating this idea that there's There's never any point when it would make sense to kill another person over the issue of where a border is drawn, whether it's in a neighborhood in the United States or between countries, or over the issue of which politician has their hand in your pocket. And so amongst young people, to try and cultivate that altruism and that, I think, often instinctive sense they have that we really are all part of one another, that we have more in common with one another than we do with the 1% elites who would rob and thieve and destroy this planet. So anticipating tomorrow that there might be opportunities to interact with the public, walking along or holding a brief vigil in front of St. Joseph's Hospital, how do we clearly express what happened on October 3rd at 2:05 in the morning when United States missiles fired from an aerial fighter jet, a C-130 transport plane outfitted with weapons, fired on the intensive care unit in the hospital building located as part of a 100-yard compound. The Médecins Sans Frontières hospital facilities are quite large. Forget that I said 100 yard, I'm sorry. The size of a football field. There's a mess hall, there's a place for people to use as a dormitory, places for people that are staff people that are outside the actual hospital. But there is one building that is the actual hospital. And very precise, very specific bombing happened in 15-minute intervals on that building and only that building, beginning with the intensive care unit, from 2:05 in the morning until 3:15 in the morning. And as soon as the bombing happened, people immediately worked to notify the authorities in the United States military and the Afghan military and the NATO forces that they were bombing a hospital. But it continued in 15-minute intervals, dropping missiles that exploded and incinerated people in their beds, including patients, and destroyed the hospital completely. They didn't aim for any other part of that collection of buildings other than the actual hospital. To me, there's not really a question about criminality when you think about war, because I believe that the very act of war is criminal. It's a crime against humanity to train other people to pick up weapons and kill other people to resolve a problem. But we do have international law that, I mean, it exists, and I think it's fair for the Doctors Without Borders, who built and sustained that hospital, who trained the staff, who maintained their presence in a very, very frightening and difficult situation before they were bombed. I think it's fair for them to say, this must be investigated, and it's patently obvious that when an airborne vehicle drops bombs on a hospital, this fits the already stipulated norms of what is called a war crime. Now, the United States initially said, well, there was a conflict and there was collateral damage. I find that phrase pernicious, yes. Collateral damage. And again, I want to remind us of the nurse who said words could not describe her horror. It might have been his horror. As patients burned in their own beds, 3 children were killed. 12 hospital staff, 22 people in all. And the entire facility is rendered useless. The United States military then said, well, actually there were Taliban inside the hospital. And so they were posing a threat to the United States military because there were special forces apparently advising the Afghan forces. But immediately, the Doctors Without Borders staff said, no, our staff have reported that there was no fighting whatsoever happening inside the hospital, that no one inside the hospital was a threat to anyone outside the hospital. And by that time, The United Nations and the Amnesty International and the International Commission of the Red Cross and quite a lot of other people were beginning to circle around the Doctors Without Borders and say, we're with you, speak up. So then the United States said, okay, that's not what happened. Then the United States military changed the story a third time and said that they were asked to bomb the hospital by the Afghan military, kind of trying to pawn the whole thing off on the but that simply, it doesn't wash at all. I want to just mention, the Taliban have no air force, right? The Afghan military right now in the books is subordinate to the United States when it comes to air actions. They're subordinate to the rules of the United States and NATO. So I don't see any way to dodge what seems patently obvious, that a military force engaged in bombing civilians inside of a hospital. Now, how do we awaken concern here in Syracuse? I think strident words may not be the way to win people over, but I think if we could have a presence that would evoke some questions, some curiosity, and then maybe start to, you know, push a little bit with the media, saying this has been in the mainstream news, it's been covered on CNN, it's been covered on NPR, it's been covered by the NBC, and could the Syracuse media cover the concerns of local people who don't want to be involved unquestioningly or unthinkingly in attacks against innocent civilians, setting a precedent that could actually jeopardize the security of people in the United States, because other people all around the world have strong feelings about these kinds of actions. One of my first encounters in Afghanistan was with a young man who said, do Americans care more about noses than human lives? And I said, what kind of question? I just don't understand. And then he helped me understand that at that time, there were a group of people who were part of a striker brigade who had been sent over to Afghanistan, and they got bored. They just were feeling a lot of malaise, I suppose. They'd been trained to kill, and there wasn't anybody to kill. So they started devising a way to involve themselves in killing. They would kill a peasant, drop a weapon on the peasant's corpse, take a picture, and then tell the rest of their division or troops or whatever, we saved everybody, or their squadron, we saved everybody because we got this guy. He was coming at us with a gun, but we killed him first. And then that kind of morphed into, well, wouldn't it be great if we could take trophies back to the United States? And so they started to cut off the body parts and store them in jars. And when one person tried to start to blow the whistle, he was beaten badly, and they became afraid of one another. So that was, my young friend was trying to say to me that when young Aisha's nose had been badly, badly damaged because of an Afghan man attacking her, and her picture went all around the United States and everybody knew this one girl, he was asking, well, don't people care about human life? In the very place where we're looking at Kunduz, there was a time when some oil tankers that were part of a United States and a European military convoy got mired down in kind of a very muddy area. They were stuck. And poor people in any part of the world seeing, you know, big tanks of fuel, well, why not? And so people came running. And they had whatever kind of containers they could carry, and they were helping themselves to this fuel that was just kind of stuck there. And a German military commander learned that there were lots of people congregating in a certain area, and so they called in the drone surveillance. They wanted to see, what's this big growing number of people coming, and is it a threat to the German squadron that was based, you know, some distance away. Probably a lot of the people coming to get the oil didn't even know that this group was even there. But they were so anxious about their own security that they called in United States military strikes, aerial bombardments, and upwards of 90 people were killed. Children, mothers, people that just were desperate for fuel. Now, it's kind of macabre, but Voices has kept the Afghan atrocities list going. And we would only list those situations in which United States forces or NATO forces were involved in actually killing other people. We didn't list all the instances of humiliation and torture and disappearances and night raids. We only listed, you know, these people were killed. And then we would try to follow up when the United States military would say, well, you know, it's under investigation. And it leaves the internet. You can't find the follow-up. So if you wanted more of those kinds of stories, it's a long and a difficult list. But I especially recommend an Amnesty International report that came out 2 years ago in the summertime, and it got almost no attention. But it gives 8 case studies of the ways in which the United States forces definitely violated and abused the human rights of Afghan people. And then Physicians for Social Responsibility last summer came out with a report, and they said at least 100,000 people, 100,000 civilians in Afghanistan have been killed since 2001. And it just didn't make a ripple. And they said that it's such a smokescreen for the United States to act as though, well, the problem is, you know, internecine battles or interreligious fighting, and never to reckon with the problem of the United States invading and occupying and bombing and creating such destabilization in the first place. So what kind of intelligence do we need? We don't need the intelligence supplied by the drones that fly overhead, the miles of camera footage being analyzed by Air Force workers who try to establish patterns of life in Afghanistan and see which person might be walking down which road. We need the intelligence that Ellen has suggested, trying to understand the consequences for people who can't escape our wars. In Angola, during a time of civil war, landmines were planted under the ground, and elephants, innocent elephants, were blown apart by those landmines. This was in 2004. There was a decrease in the elephant population. But I just read recently in The Economist from a group called Voices for Elephants, I love this, that the elephants have figured out how to detect where the landmines are. And sometimes it's because the survivors of previous blasts remember. Elephants have tremendous memory. They remember. And then they, using signals with their trunks or guttural vocal signals, warn the other elephants in the herd. And much to the amazement of people in Angola, the elephants are surviving. If the elephants can do it! I know we're the ones who plant the landmines, make the landmines, but maybe there's hope for us. Thank you very much.